Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
Oh, power's a hollow crown, Brian. Why do people aspire to it? What I mean is, people seek power as a means to an end. And to what end? Surely it is status, money, power, fast cars, big house, enormous amounts of sex, copious quantities of restricted substances, seats on boards, seats on faces. And I have all those things already. Why should I burden myself with the paltry trappings of office in this tuppenny halfpenny country? No, I've been offered ministerial office on several occasions. 3 times since last Thursday. And Mrs. May begged me to enter the cabinet. I mean, you know, Parliament's just a second-rate debating society with a third-rate cafeteria. Well, if it wasn't for the free parking space, I don't think I'd bother.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, former Sunday Times journalist Kevin Carhill, and me, Tony Gosling. Who are really the top of the rich list? Hiding wealth from the taxman, tiptoed around by the Sunday Times. There's a dark art of the 21st century. It's called hiding your wealth. And paying lawyers to threaten publishers. Keep that wealth out of the public eye. Kevin Carhill's looking at the real rich list tonight. Also, Northern Ireland, some members of the British Armed Forces could be facing fresh prosecutions despite the Northern Ireland Agreement amnesty. And the Nicaraguan ambassador to Britain, Dicel Morales Everacci, was in Bristol this week as part of sporting links between the two countries. We hear about her country's tense relationship with the United States. Bristol explorer John Cabot, hero or chancer and criminal on the run from justice in Venice. We hear about the Cabot family's role also in one of America's darkest and most powerful secret societies. Finally, in an exclusive interview with New York historian Stephen Kinzer, Operation Sunrise, and how the Dulles brothers in the United States got the Cold War going before World War II had even finished. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday this week. Montpellier-based health journalist Sally Bear explains why she is so concerned about 5G. She's demanding the council pause the rollout until they can prove it's safe. Former MEP for the South West, now living in Spain, Richard Cottrell, opened an Italian can of worms about why 15th century Bristol explorer John Cabot was chased out of Venice as a criminal and pursued right across Europe by the Doge's sheriffs. And David Ellis is concerned about the European Defence Union creating an EU army by the back door despite Brexit. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. We start with Kevin Carhill. From your days on the Sunday Times, Kevin, I know that you are a little bit sceptical about today's modern rich list, aren't you?
Yeah. But just to briefly remind people, the richest person in Britain is Anglo-Indian, and it's the Hindu. It's a family, the Hinduja family. They're worth £22 billion. The top 10 only contains two what might be called native Brits, and both of them have left. Jim Ratcliffe, who's number 3, has moved to Monaco, and James Dyson has moved to Singapore. So, two things. Just the really, really rich in the world seem to like to live in Britain. And it's very interesting, but the native Brits are hidden down the list.
Surely the really, really rich from around the world don't like to live here. They just like to have a London pad.
No, most of them establish big premises, buy farms, and set up businesses.
So you're getting at least a kind of big London pad and a kind of country retreat, that sort of thing, and businesses too.
Yeah, a lot of them do business here.
Why is the attraction of Britain for these people then? London? Is it just because there's, you know, nice pubs or, you know, good restaurants? What is it?
I think the biggest attraction of all is London is safe compared with most cities. You know, we've had knife crime and all sorts of problems, but for the rich, London is probably, after Tokyo, one of the safest cities on earth. And it's a lovely place to live. You know, there's theatre, there's all sorts of things. And it's very easy to do business in Britain.
And do the criminals control the police in London? Because, I mean, that's one of the serious problems, isn't it? Organised crime. I mean, we started with the Richardson brothers in South London and the Crays, apparently, in the 1960s. But there is, I mean, and we've seen with this story we covered before the news on the Financial Conduct Authority, some of the most really richest criminals seem to be able to get away with it in London.
Well, the most prevalent form of criminality in London and Britain is tax dodging. It's slightly different. People are a bit over-influenced by line of duty because it seemed to be the entire Met was full of corrupt officers and in league with the OGCs, the organised criminal groups. But there is a problem, and there's a problem in London, but if you're very rich in London, you're safe. And that's probably why most of them are here.
We had a story on, it was Channel 4 News this week, anti-corruption officers in Scotland Yard being investigated over allegations of rigging disciplinaries. So this is Simon Israel reporting on Wednesday. Tuesday. It's a serious question. Are the police actually doing their job, the Metropolitan Police?
Well, I worked in London for a long time, and the short answer is yes, they are. In all human organisations, you're always going to get corruption. And the question is, how bad is it? And I don't know. Simon Israel's discoveries were nasty.
So if it's a disciplinary hearing of some sort, then they're being rigged. So someone is being put on a disciplinary for corruption of some sort, and they're being found not guilty because those investigations are rigged. And, of course, the real problem with the police is who polices the police?
Who
polices the police?
This week, I myself had an example of who's running the police. It's the Home Office. The happy British notion is that the police are local and they act for us locally. There is a problem. A lot of senior police men and women think they're part of a state police force. They have forgotten that they are there to act and keep law and order on behalf of the people, the state.
It's all very hierarchical, isn't it? You just do what your boss tells you without any question, really. And the law is maybe a secondary consideration.
Yeah. Well, I lived in London at a time when there was huge corruption, especially in the Vice Squad, back in Soho. And the curious thing was the person who cleaned up Soho wasn't a policeman. It was Paul Raymond, the porn baron. There is a problem. The police, the senior officers think they're acting for the state, and they're not.
Martin Summers, a unique selling point of London could be, couldn't it, that if you're super rich, you can get away with pretty much anything in London?
Well, yeah, and of course, we were talking earlier in the first hour about the sort of rules in the City of London. In actual fact, you can do stuff in the City of London that you can't do in New York because the rules, the financial services rules are tighter. And basically, Britain is the, you know, the wealthy criminals of the world come here and they send their children to our private schools. You know, all these Russian oligarchs and all the rest of it all got their boys in Eton.
An interesting, unique selling point, isn't it, for London? Anyway, back to your aristocratic rich list, Kevin. Who do you think should be on that rich list that isn't, or should be much higher up than they are actually by the Sunday Times?
The Queen is down amongst the 400s. the first act of the coalition government in 2010 was to confirm the Queen's ownership of the Crown Estate. The minimum value of the Crown Estate is $11.5 billion. So the Queen really should be at number 8. Currently number 8 is Alisher Usmanov.
Well, someone needs to tell Alisha that they've been knocked off the number 8 position.
The Queen. Of course, the eye raises it. But the second person who's missing from the list is Rupert Murdoch. A lot of the foreign oligarchs who are on the list, Murdoch, if they're on the list, Murdoch should be on the list as well.
So where would he be on the list?
Murdoch is somewhere about, currently about 11 billion. He'd be about much the same, number 7 or 8.
So, to what extent can you yourself, with a bit of time and expertise, dig into people's real wealth? Because we've heard there's two major areas where we're not getting their wealth on the Sunday Times Rich List. One is land ownership, and another one is the wealth they've squirreled away in offshore accounts, in tax havens.
Well, the offshore tax, the very first Rich List in 1989, we discovered that one of the reasons we had a Rich List and people on it was because most of them kept their assets registered in places like Jersey, Guernsey, Cayman Islands, etc. Serious assets were not registered in Britain. So you need a change there. You need to stop. Anything that's property in Britain should be registered in Britain and the owners should be shown. That's a fundamental change. And everything Martin mentioned, the big oligarchs doing what they like in the city, that's one of the reasons. There's no asset register.
What about aristocratic landowners then? I mean, there are others, aren't there? The Queen is not the only one. There's things like the... I mean, how does something like the Duchy of Lancaster sit with all this? Because the money goes to the monarch, although there's actually no Duke of Lancaster.
She is the Duke.
Oh, she is she?
She is,
She's also the Queen and the Duke of Lancaster all in one.
She's an old Duchess. She's got about... I think I counted the titles once. 38 crowns and about 38 titles as well, but she's the Duke of Lancaster, so she gets all the money. The dukedom is set up under law, so the Lancaster dukedom is very hard to attack because it's a kind of a statutory structure with the strange proviso that all the money goes to the Queen.
So it's got a little law all to itself.
It's a law all to itself.
So it's not. It doesn't have to fit in with anything like company law or anything, a bit like our wonderful merchant ventures here in Bristol. Okay, what about people like the Duke of Westminster, Duke of Buccleuch? Because these are massive landowners of, big parts of Scotland, etc. But they're also landowners in central London, in places like Mayfair. I mean, we often forget about who owns those places. And there are specific individuals that have been holding on to that land for, say, 700 years. They haven't.
Yeah,
their family
the Grosvenors have had it for about 400. But nobody is quite sure where the ultimate registration of the trusts that own the Grosvenor estate. Cleverly, the current Duke's dad put down in the accounts that he was the ultimate beneficiary. He just didn't say where the assets were actually held. Again, almost certainly they're offshore.
Martin Summers, how do these land holdings, I mean, we're hearing, for example, about the Duchy of Lancaster, which is about 50,000 acres of land in England and Wales. We often forget about the fact that quite a lot of aristocrats have got these vast land holdings. How does that old feudal class compare with the more modern traders and the merchant classes, I suppose we'd call them?
Well, I think what is surprising to people is how much the old money does dominate landed property, and in actual fact lots of it has never changed hands at all, because it's never changed hands, there's never been any register of who owns it, and the, you know, and what tended to happen traditionally is the wealthy merchants in the city of London married into the aristocracy and then basically became aristocrats by default, what they used to call gentlemanly capitalism. So that in actual fact, the, you know, the structure of British economy and the way it worked was a kind of hybrid between merchant capital and traditional aristocratic landed wealth. And they were basically fused. And that's, you know, those are the people who still run it.
So now. Is actually no, any difference anymore between the feudal landowners and the people who are basically money classes, the merchant classes?
Well, there's a huge overlap. They intermarry. They all go to the same schools. They go to the same universities. They, you know, it's an elite. And land ownership is the final kind of thing that you get once you, you know, I mean, James Dyson or whatever is an entrepreneur, but I'll bet you you'll ultimately end up buying quite a lot of property because that's what you do.
He actually has.
He's one of the major landowners now. Now, he has bought the land he has bought.
Just stop you for a second. Just to say, about 50,000 acres, that's about two-thirds of a county. So it's quite large. Maybe a half a county, you know, your average county. I mean, that's quite, you know, big size.
Your average county is 400,000 acres, but it's a big lump. And usually, and the stuff he has bought is prime land, it's good land. He hasn't bought swamps. But that will be registered because it's been transacted recently.
Okay.
So that'll be recorded in the land registry.
Okay, so who are the other big people that you want to mention, Kevin?
Well, you've got in London, and they're very high up in the rich list, they're number 16, are the De Walden family, who all the freeholds all around Harley Street and Marylebone and Marble Arch. Then you've got Grosvenor, you've got Buccleuch, who has land in London as well as Scotland, and big farm holdings in England. But he persuaded the rich list once that as all the paintings and everything and assets were in trust, he was relatively poor, you know, only a couple of hundred million. Buccleuch is worth a couple of billion plus.
Well, we've had Who Owns Britain, your book, came out not long after the turn of the century. And then we've had earlier this year, Guy Shrubsole's Who Owns England. The BBC reporting this week, Who Owns Scotland? The Changing Face of Scotland's Landowners, by Andrew Picken and Stuart Nicholson on the BBC website. So it's a very difficult question to answer, they say. They're scratching their heads. Scottish Government project aims to map who owns all of the country by 2024. It was launched 5 years ago, but so far it's only managed to register about a third of the country.
Yeah. He's an MSP, Scottish MP, in the Scottish Parliament. Andy Whiteman has actually set up a system that has got about 60% of Scotland's land holdings. He extracted them from the land registry, and you can dial into his website and you pay a fee, a small fee, and you can pick up most of the estates now. It's more is registered than is shown on the Scottish project.
Isn't there some sort of a defamation case against Andy Whiteman? Do you know about that at all? Because I heard about that recently.
Well, if he's being sued for defamation, it's probably because he's doing something right.
Wildcat Haven Enterprises took Andy Whiteman to court over posts he published on his personal blog. Lothian's MSP land reform campaign had crowdfunded more than £30,000 to fight the case. They were ordered to put up a security of £50,000 in order to push on with it. So he's criticising some of these landowners. They're fighting back financially.
Yeah, Andy has been a thorn in the side of the big landowners. Andy has two issues. One is the uneven distribution of land in Scotland, where the bulk of it is owned by a very small group of people. And he has been fierce over 20 years in criticising them. And yes, they hate him. And they will do anything to try and stop
anyone interested in Andy. His book is most recent one, I think, is called The Poor Had No Lawyers.
It's a fabulous book and it's fascinating. And it's the bottom. Now he's a victim of the system. You can only fight in the law if you're rich. So if you're not rich, you can't fight.
That is not supposed to be the principle of justice, is it? It's supposed to be access for everybody.
Well, you could. We should. We won't this time. But there you see Andy being, you know, got at because he's an MSP and he's not rich.
Okay, so any more to say about aristocratic landowners? The Duke of Westminster, he's quite a big landowner. Is he not number two behind the Queen?
If the Queen would be, what did we say? The Queen would be eight. He's currently 14, and he's under, I think, undervalued. Back when I was doing the rich list, one of the extraordinary discoveries was the Guinness. It's called the Ivy Trust. And again, the Earl of Ivy has 25,000 acres, which is a big lump of anybody's county, up in Suffolk. But we thought it was worth about $1 billion. But then I met one of the directors, a retiring director, and the trust was worth $11 billion. So that's the Guinness, you know, this is the Guinness family. They still have $11 billion tucked away in Switzerland.
And whilst we're on the subject of the monarchy, what's going to happen with Prince Charles? I noticed that the Daily Star revealed this week that there's all these secret meetings taking place, making sure that when the Queen dies, that there's some sort of wonderful succession and he takes over very smoothly. And he knows already all the people running the Duchy of Lancaster and he gets his money on time.
The duchy will go to, when the Queen dies, Charles becomes king, the duchy will go to William, and Kate becomes the Duchess of Cornwall. So, but the transfer of the Crown estate and the Duchy of Cornwall, which is where all the land is locked up in statute. He will pay no tax on the transfer.
Is it a bit tasteless discussing this sort of thing about the Queen dying? Although she's bound to. She seems to have quite a lot of life left in her.
I don't think it's tasteless. And after the Who Owns the World came out, and I had identified the Queen as the largest landowner on Earth, the largest legal landowner, I met her and she didn't complain. She didn't say anything. I thought
maybe she didn't know. Maybe she'd not read the book.
I doubt if something like a book like that had even reached her notice. But I think most democratic countries, you know, the MPs have to register their interests and everything. And we've got an extremely rich, ultra top end of it, which has to register nothing. I think for their public functions, they should have to disclose their assets.
Okay, Kevin, we're going to move on now to look at Northern Ireland because in the Prime Minister's questions this week, I noticed lots and lots of MPs asking questions about potential new prosecutions.
Aidan Paterson.
Mr. Speaker, in reply to my right honourable friend for Chingford and Woodford Green, the Prime Minister quite rightly paid tribute to the 300,000 security personnel who, through their courage, professionalism and skill, maintained the rule of law, without which the Belfast Agreement would never have been signed.
Correct.
But she didn't quite answer his question. None of those people who serve defending the rule of law want a blanket amnesty. Correct. What they want is a categorical assurance that the prosecuting authorities within the existing framework of law will not bring forward a fresh process and that it is categorical, clear new evidence. And there is an assurance, and no doubt whatever, that a fair trial will proceed.
Well, can I say to you, friend, I absolutely appreciate the point that he and our right honourable friend, the member for Chingford and Wood Green, has made in relation to this issue. The problem we face in Northern Ireland is that there have been a number of processes which have been aiming to deal with these issues and justice in relation to these deaths during the Troubles. But all of the processes that have been followed so far have been found to be flawed in some way. That is why it is necessary to go through this the work that we have been doing to find a process that will not be flawed, that will be legally supportable, and that will enable the fairness and justice that we all want to see to be brought to the fore.
I detect a little bit of nervousness in the Prime Minister's voice there, Martin, over this subject. I think probably triggered by Penny Mordaunt, the new Defence Secretary, proposing a new law to protect troops from prosecution.
Yeah, not just in Northern Ireland, of course, it's in other places as well. I think the problem with, you know, the Belfast Agreement and all the rest of it, if there's still lots of loose ends and messiness, what Sinn Féin have been calling for all along is a truth and reconciliation process where people come forward and say what they've done, including, for example, Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who used to run the Force Research Unit, which was basically directing the Loyalist paramilitaries. Most British people don't understand that in actual fact that's what went on, and that the state didn't just make a few little mistakes here and there. They had a policy of basically supporting terrorism.
Okay, so they're saying in the Commons there that the army was there to institute and support the rule of law.
Well, that's what they would say, but in actual fact, Sir John Stevens used to head up the Metropolitan Police, investigated all of this, and he went to Jackson, who was head of the army, and said, I'm afraid your brigadier is going to have to stand trial as a terrorist. But he was shot. That was all hushed up and closed down, but the evidence is all there. There's been John Ware's panorama programmes exposed all of this years ago, and of course most people in Britain have got a very vague understanding of what Irish politics is about. They think that the IRA were blowing things up and that we tried to stop, bring peace to the, and then eventually the IRA saw reason, blah blah blah. But of course the British Army was a player, wasn't just a passive function of what's going on.
Well, some would say the British Army started it on Bloody Sunday.
Well, I think pointing fingers about who started it is not really terribly constructive. The fact is that everything went off the rails pretty rapidly, and everybody's got things to regret, and that certainly includes the British Army.
I was in the British Army in Northern Ireland the year everything started to come apart.
So is that in 72 or what?
Yeah. There's an absolute tragedy. 40 years later is too late to try and get justice for anybody. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission is the only way forward. If soldiers are not going to be prosecuted for things that happened 40 years ago, what's really wrong is 40 years should not have passed without an investigation, because you've got Bloody Sunday on the one hand, which the Savile report said the people who were shot weren't carrying guns and they shouldn't have been shot. They were innocent. That means who ordered the troops to fire? And the answer was apparently there were no orders. This is a breakdown of military discipline.
Well, isn't that just a commander on the ground covering his tracks and saying, I never said that?
Well, there's another problem. If you have a civil situation, you don't and can't send in battle troops like the Paras. That's not what they're trained for. But they should never have been sent there.
I mean, Britain seems to have a bit of a problem with this, isn't it? We've had the child sex abuse stuff, which has been going on for decades. The Hillsborough inquiry going on for decades. Why do we have to wait so long, apparently, for this?
It's the way the establishment fudge everything. If they make a mistake, one of the factors they use to kill, you know, to stop people being prosecuted or brought to justice is time. They factor time into it, and it becomes 28 years for Hillsborough, 40 years for Bloody Sunday, and now look at Ballymurphy, which is even older, and nobody seems to have even known about it.
Well, one of the people apparently involved in Northern Ireland was the former Tory leader, Ian Duncan Smith. He also, when he was at Prime Minister's Questions this week, had put his two halfpence in.
Mr. Ian Duncan Smith.
Mr. Speaker, 43 years ago, I, like many others, was ordered to serve in Northern Ireland to keep the peace by terrorists attacking and killing civilians in Northern Ireland. Many of my colleagues and others did not come back, including one, Robert Nairac, a friend, who was tortured, murdered, and his body has never been found, nor his murderers ever been brought to justice. I simply say to my right honourable friend that in answer to our honourable friend's earlier question, she talked about an amnesty. I must tell her that none of those who served have called for an amnesty. What they have called for is fairness and justice. Many, many old veterans now are finding, having been cleared decades ago, that the PSNI is now proceeding against them with no new evidence. Can I please ask her, will she answer me, how is it that I can say to my old colleagues that this government has not abandoned them?
Prime Minister!
My right honourable friend, we absolutely value the service that he and others did in Northern Ireland. This was a very difficult time for a part of the United Kingdom. And the work that the police did and that the armed forces did in Northern Ireland during that time was absolutely crucial. We are pleased that we've seen the peace that has come since the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. But there was obviously much injury and loss of life during the Troubles. As I indicated earlier, around 3,500 people were killed during the Troubles. The vast majority of those were murdered by terrorists. My right honourable friend talks about a fair and just system. We want to ensure that there is a fair and just system that is working across the board to deal with these legacy issues. But what is happening at the moment is that there is a disproportionate emphasis in terms of cases that involve the police and the armed forces. There are cases involving terrorists that are being looked into, but I think people would recognise that there is a disproportionate emphasis on the police and armed forces. What is important is that we therefore bring in a system which has full support and which will enable people to see that fairness and justice being applied. That is what the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland is working on. She has been working on that with the various political parties in Northern Ireland, and it is what we will, in due course, put forward. We recognise the sacrifice and the bravery and determination of our armed forces and the work they did in Northern Ireland, and we too want to see fairness and justice.
Your two points, Tony, focused around Bloody Sunday. Bloody Sunday was, what, 40 years ago. 13 people were killed. And after 40 years, the Savile report says they were innocent. Well, why did 40 years elapse before, say, military law was invoked to try and identify the people who had fired without orders? And how do you resolve it now? And I am pessimistic. I think you cannot deliver justice after 40 years, especially when the whole process has been mangled, corrupted, where the corruption of persistent delay has been applied. The people who should be before the courts are the people who caused that to happen.
Martin, why do you think the PSNI are picking on more soldiers than they are on so-called terrorists?
They're not. The PSNI, of course, are harassing McKinney and McCaffrey and McKinney. I can't remember the names of the guys now who exposed in their film No Stone Unturned.
We covered that a few weeks
ago.
Yeah,
the then RUC were colluding with the UVF during the Lochan Island massacre. The bombs in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, planted by the Glenane gang, they were working with MI5. Now, most British people still haven't got it through their heads that the British state itself has been engaged in terrorism. Loyalist terrorists were working hand in glove with the British Army.
Some people will say that some people in the British Army rather like the whole Northern Ireland situation, as it provided live urban warfare training.
Well, indeed, and they were also quite cocky when they arrived as well, because they thought we'll squash this pretty quickly, and then it turned into a situation where two Tory prime ministers were nearly assassinated, and then you've got to shake hands with the guys who gave the orders for that, because that's what it's like. You fight and you talk and then you negotiate and hopefully you find some peace. I think ultimately there'll have to be some kind of reconciliation process where people come forward, like Brigadier Gordon Kerr. He ought to be prosecuted, he ought to be sent to prison because he was orchestrating the Loyalist terror campaign. I would just say we just want him to testify, we want to get it out of the way. And of course it's important because there's other terrorist attacks going on in this country in which the security services are implicated, and the ordinary population needs to understand how the security services and the military actually operate. They're not peacekeepers.
Interesting,
they never were.
Interesting point, because last week in the I paper, MI5 may have radicalised Jihadi John. Attempts by Britain's security services to recruit the British Islamic extremist, who became the notorious Jihadi John terrorist, may have further radicalised him, a senior former counter-terrorism chief has said. Richard Walton, former head of counter-terrorism at Scotland Yard, revealed on Channel 4's The Hunt for Jihadi John that security services tried to recruit him. Now, the way that they do this recruiting is sometimes just like a red rag to a bull, Kevin. or Martin, whoever.
Well, I mean, it's the point is that Al Qaeda was set up in the 1980s by MI6 to fight the Russians in Afghanistan, and people from all over the world were recruited and trained and infiltrated into Afghanistan via Pakistan, and a lot of them came from Libya, a lot of them came from Pakistan itself. Some of them were British, and of course there's British people inside Syria now fighting the Syrian army, who are basically under the direction of Western intelligence services, including MI6. Jihadi terrorism was orchestrated by the under Operation Cyclone. MI6 was the lead agency. Libyan Islamic Fighting Group are based in Manchester. They've been based there since the 1980s. That's the reality of what they do.
Kevin, and can not I put to you, as someone that actually served in the army, is it a conspiracy theory to say, well, maybe the British Army quite liked this urban warfare situation they were in?
Worse than that, I can actually confirm that there were some in the British Army. I've actually had it said to me that we were the only army in the world which was getting live training. It wasn't ultimately, and it did come to a head somewhere I was present. It took us 6 years to defeat Nazi Germany. The same army is bogged down in Northern Ireland for 35 years. And even the army began to wonder, how did that happen? But the army persistently told the politicians that they could solve the problem militarily, and you can't. Well, civil contingencies don't work like that.
There was another aspect to Northern Ireland. That was the systemic child sexual abuse, which apparently has been taken out of the National Inquiry, which is being conducted at the moment by Alexis Jay. And that came up in Prime Minister's Questions too.
Nigel Dodds!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. For over 2 years now, the victims and survivors of historical institutional abuse in Northern Ireland have been waiting for justice and compensation following the independent report of Mr. Justice Hart, or ex-Justice Hart. The fact of the matter is many of them are dying without seeing the compensation come through. The NIO's policy of refusing to do anything in Northern Ireland, even when it has cross-community and cross-party support, has now come to the culmination of victims of abuse dying without seeing justice. Yeah. This has got to stop. Will the Prime Minister intervene and make sure that action is taken to get immediate action for these victims?
Yeah. Well, can I say to the
Prime Minister,
I fully appreciate the extent of concern that there is about this issue. Of course, we have the wider. We also have our independent inquiry into child sexual abuse here in England and Wales, and I recognise that the impact on all those who have been victims of this sort of abuse. We call it historical. He refers. The investigation is referred to as historical investigation. For those who have been victims, it is not historical. It rests with them for the rest of their life. I recognise the concern about the issue that he has raised. Obviously, if the Northern Ireland Executive were in place, this would be a matter that the Northern Ireland Executive would be... No, it would be a matter the Northern Ireland Executive would be addressing. My right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, has been looking at this issue, and I will help discuss with her what response can be given on what I recognise is a matter of deep concern to many people in Northern Ireland.
Well, actually, the Northern Ireland Secretary is Karen Bradley, and she has actually reacted to that question by Nigel Dodds from the DUP there, saying that she's, well, there's a BBC article saying she historical abuse hits back at shying away, claims that they're shying away. She's denied she's shying away from her responsibility to help release compensation for victims of historical institutional abuse in Northern Ireland. Nigel Dodds made the accusation we just heard there, but she said she needs the political parties to respond to a document from her department. She faced questions from a number of MPs who urged her to end the agony of victims, with Labour's Conor McGinn accusing her of not understanding the sense of outrage across Northern Ireland about the matter. The Secretary of State said she had met the victims and understood what they were going through, and added there was an opportunity to make quick progress. Well, it sounds to me a little bit like what you were saying before, Kevin, this about just the government just using kicking the can down the road as a cynical tactic.
Yeah, and using the absence of the Northern Ireland Executive, you know, as an excuse.
It's been without a functioning government. No, there's been no Stormont, has there, Martin?
Well, can I just add another point, is that the role of MI5 in what went on in King Korra is not being mentioned here.
No.
Yes, well, this isn't just abuse by nasty people running children's homes. It's this intelligence services using young people in order to achieve their nefarious goals. And that's what people should be focused on, just as they should be focused on the British Army's relationship with the Loyalist paramilitaries. Because everybody just keeps evading the fundamental truths here, which is that the British state is criminal, and it's been criminal for a very long time, in a very deep way.
So these are victims of historical institutional abuse in children's homes. Yeah. But anyway, that one. Any idea
how? It's a side issue. Okay, the historical child sex abuse inquiry, the Independent, is running now. You know, it's running through these weeks. On Monday, the Historical Child Sex Abuse Inquiry heard evidence from Microsoft, Apple, Google, and Facebook. The House of Commons on the 17th of April last year and on the 14th of February this year called those four companies criminal corporations. And the reason they were called criminal corporations in the House of Commons record is because they are intercepting and stealing children's data. They're abusing children. So the abusers get to actually be witnesses. Absurd situation.
Well, we discussed, I think, a couple of months ago, the fact that Harvey Proctor, who's convicted of some child molestation offences, has actually also been made a core participant of the institutional abuse inquiry, whereas two women who alleged that they were abused in Westminster when they were children, they have been denied core participant status. So it's a very, very peculiar inquiry, this.
It's a very odd inquiry.
What one has to do, if you want to follow what's going on there, is there seems to be just about only Mark Watts on Twitter is one of the best people to follow on that. And from time to time, he'll get an article in one of the newspapers about it.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available if you have any questions. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Well, from time to time, we hear news stories, well, I say that probably once a week, about how the Russians are trying to fix our elections. This week, from the Associated Press, Facebook busts Israeli-based campaign to disrupt elections. This is Facebook on Thursday said it banned an Israeli company that ran an influence campaign aimed at disrupting elections in various countries and has cancelled dozens of accounts engaged in spreading disinformation. Nathaniel Gleicher, Facebook's head of cybersecurity policy, told reporters the tech giant had purged 65 Israeli accounts, 161 pages, dozens of groups and four Instagram accounts. Although Facebook said the individuals behind the network attempted to conceal their identities, it discovered many were linked to Archimedes Group, a Tel Aviv-based political consulting and lobbying firm that publicly boasts of its social media skills and ability to change reality.
Yeah, there's the other story, this again at the beginning of the week or the week before, where an Israeli company sold the Saudis the surveillance stuff that was used to catch poor old Khashoggi before he was murdered in the consulate. The Israeli intelligence services in particular, a very extensive part of the hacking and data theft undergrowth. And nobody pays much attention to them. They always tend to work in association with American tech giants, all of whom, the nine of whom, the big ones, have been described in the House of Commons record as criminal corporations.
The thing is, if the Israelis are some of the best people in the world at this, are they on the side of the angels or the demons?
They're on their own side. They're not on... And to judge by the way the surveillance equipment was used to help arrange the murder of Khashoggi, they are pretending it's nothing to do with them. They don't mind who they sell it to.
Well, another tech story this week. Now's your chance to tell ICANN how you feel about Amazon's domain battle with the rainforest. This is on Fast Company website, but there's lots of people covering this. This was a particularly good article, I thought. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. An eight-year-long legal battle between the countries that surround the Amazon River and rainforest and the company Amazon.com is drawing to a close. A court will decide whether Amazon.com has exclusive right to use the .amazon domain name, or whether the eight South American countries that share the Amazon River, that's Bolivia, Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, Guyana, Peru, Suriname and Venezuela, also have rights to the domain name. So this is a bit of an interesting one, isn't it? Now, who's going to win, do you think, Kevin?
With so many countries involved, they have a chance. And I don't think it was nefarious. Bezos is the guy who virtually owns Amazon. It was a cute name. I don't think he started out in any conspiratorial sense. But now that he's grown so big, there really is an encroachment on the rights of the countries on the banks of the river. They have a chance, I think.
ICANN indicated Amazon.com's application to use the name might be turned down due to the fact that there is an actual river and an actual rainforest and thousands of people who aren't Jeff Bezos who have a right to the domain name.
Yeah, the millions of people. You've named all the countries, but there are actually millions of people
living. But I mean, isn't this actually a brilliant story? Because it's exactly about the modern dilemma. These massive tech giants and big corporations today are bigger, more powerful than countries. And I think we should keep an eye on this, because if Amazon.com wins this, that shows you that the corporations nowadays are far more powerful than countries.
Well, as you know, on my own story, that's the problem. They are. And that's the problem I encounter all the time. The United Kingdom, according to the House of Commons record, is suffering 70% mass surveillance by nine named internet giants, including Google, Facebook, and so on.
Martin,
and nobody can stop them.
What do you make of this? Because we keep hearing it's the Russians that are doing all this. It's actually not. It's the Israelis, apparently.
Well,
in the previous case.
Well, that's right. I mean, and of course, Edward Snowden has showed that the existing tech giants are basically watching everybody on behalf of the CIA and others.
The NSA.
Well, NSA, whatever. It's the alphabet soup. And of course, anybody realises that the problem with modern technologies is hackable. Anybody can watch anybody, and they are. And the idea that Huawei or the Russians are any more involved in this than our people is absurd. They're all doing it because that's what they do.
The whole Russian thing, and to some extent the Israeli thing, is just a diversion. The real hackers are the nine corporations.
Well, you
under
mentioned,
contract yeah. to the National Security
You mentioned agency. Huawei again there, and I spoke for an extended interview on Dialect next week on Tuesday lunchtime with Sally Baer, who's just launched a petition in Bristol here asking for the rollout of 5G, this new data mobile network, to be paused.
We're asking that the precautionary principle is invoked in the city of Bristol, and we're really encouraging other local towns and communities to do the same in their areas. But since the central government's not going to listen to us, we're going for appealing to the councillors and our mayor. So with this petition, we're asking there is a pause in 5G rollout, ideally for 5 years. We think that's the absolute minimum that you should be looking at safety during, not 2 months, as this lady says, while the safety is proven. The safety should be proven before we and our children are subjected to this technology. And at the bottom of the petition, we've put some useful links. And I'll just mention some of them. These are some of the groups of scientists who are gravely concerned about 5G. So first of all, this is how my ears first pricked up about 5G, was because the Professor Emeritus of Biochemistry at Washington State University, Martin Poole, there's a video going around. He has said that 5G is the stupidest idea in the history of the world. So he studied the effect of electromagnetic radiation on body cells, and he's an authority on the subject. There are various groups who, I'm sorry, I'm not going to listen to the telecoms industry or our politicians over these groups. There's the American group Physicians for Safe Technology. They state there is convincing emerging scientific evidence causing great concern for the environment with harm to mammals, insects and bacteria. 5G technology will also consume significant amounts of energy, contrary to global climate goals. Then you've got the 5G space appeal, which has got hundreds of scientists involved in it. They're appealing for a halt. They're saying RF radiation has been proven harmful for humans and the environment. The deployment of 5G constitutes an experiment on humanity and the environment that is defined as a crime under international law. Then there's 230 scientists from all over the world. They've stated in the International EMF Scientist Appeal, numerous recent scientific publications have shown that EMF affects living organisms at levels well below most international and national guidelines. There are several of these groups, and there are a ton of studies. So I don't think that that's paranoia. I think that's looking at the existing evidence and being a bit sceptical about the real reasons why 5G is being rolled out. It's not just about progress. It's about huge economic benefits for a small group of people.
Yeah. We humans have been around for a couple of million years, and we have never bombarded ourselves with so much of microwaves. Suddenly the atmosphere is full of microwaves, and we weren't built for that. This is basic.
Well, one of the problems with this 5G is it's actually a lot more dense, more powerful, and more high frequency than the previous types. And I won't have any Wi-Fi in my house. I don't know about you folks, but when I first switched it on, I was quite sceptical about all these anti-Wi-Fi people. I first switched it on, I thought, oh, gosh, I can feel that in the house. I don't really want it in here. Thank you very much. And God knows what 5G is going to be like. I'll put a link, of course, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the Pause 5G in Bristol petition with Sally Beer. Now, also this week, we got the Nicaraguan ambassador here talking about US relations here in Bristol.
In the United States government, the State Department, they have been very clear that they put the three countries and they call us the axis of evil. So we're talking about Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. And we have never been a threat to the United States. The only thing that our countries have done is to try to eradicate poverty and social development. That's the only thing we want. Leave us alone. But since last year, in the case of Nicaragua, was approved the NICA Act. The NICA Act is it's a law especially made for Nicaragua to impose sanctions, to impose a blockade in the terms of financial blockade. So that's the thing is to make, I don't know, they think that it's going to act in favor of the opposition, so the people get tired. Because they feel they don't have economically advancement, so they will go against the government. But they don't know our people. You see how Cuba has succeeded, despite how they have advanced socially, despite of the blockade. So we have part of these discussions and that this dialogue that we're having. One of the things that are in discussions is to issue when we get is to issue from both parts, the opposition and that did this violence, the Allah, to have a letter to the US saying to lift that sanctions and to revoke that law that is called NICA Act. It's a USA law approved to impose sanctions in another country. So that's how they work when they want to intervene and they don't want to do a military, so they do it economically.
Thanks very much to Rosabel from the Spanish Window Show for that interview. Martin, the Bristol Nicaragua group. Be nice to see if the ambassador's in town. get her on Points West or something. But I mean, this what's happening to Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba is a kind of targeting. They're calling them, what is it, the Axis?
The Axis of Tyranny. If you got that wrong, they're not the Axis of Tyranny. The Axis of Tyranny is, I believe, the phrase that Pompeo was using. And of course, the Americans have dominated Central and South America for decades and imposed all sorts of miserable stuff on them, got them into debt under military dictators, then made the democratic governments repay the debt which they hadn't really contracted, and everybody who steps out of line, particularly Nicaragua, Venezuela and Cuba, sanctions to try and make their people poorer. And of course, they, you know, they're basically bullies. Everybody knows. Well, they're our allies.
Sorry, we haven't got time for the Richard Cottrell talking about John Cabot. I'm afraid you have to wait till next Tuesday lunchtime with the full interview with him on our Dialect show at midday, between midday and one. But we do have Chris Mulligan, publisher in the United States in the West Coast, talking about secret societies and how they work in the United States and John Cabot's role there.
A secret society, no matter where they are, they're always the same, whether you're talking in Africa, the Orient, or in the Occident. And you generally have a ball of wax or a pyramid. You have a lot of people on the outside, or in Masonic circles, they call them porch brethren. They're good for favors, but they really don't know what's going on. And then you have an administrative cadre, because at any time in any organization, there are the people that turn the lights off and on. And then you have a core group. In the core group, they're always all related. They're all cousins. Like Skull and Bones is built around the Cabot family. You're based in Bristol. I think you've heard about the Cabots now and then, with a big subset of the Whitney family. Most of the people in Masonic circles have no idea of what is going on. They can be, anytime you're a member of a pyramidal organization and somebody above you is supposed to tell you what to do, it can be used and abused. And, a secret society is a thing, just like anything. And it can be used for good or ill. It depends on what people do with it.
Good point from Chris Mulligan there. But he's saying there, he's actually the author, Kevin, of something called Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. And the Skull and Bones Secret Society in the United States is actually very powerful.
Yeah, no, this is where it's pretty well confined, as certain things are here, to Oxford and Cambridge, to Harvard, Yale, and the top, the elite of America, seem to belong to it.
Say, time for sign off for the US owned Comcast News at 8. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, and comment page in our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre.